And it's a good afternoon. How are you? I'm trying to hear myself in the studio and I can't hear myself. This is what happens. This is what happens when one is in the studio and one can't hear oneself. So I'm literally talking, and because I can't hear myself, I don't know whether you're hearing me. I've got my headphones on. If you're watching me, okay, now I'm hearing myself. If you're watching me, if you're watching us, you should know that Zainab is sitting next to me as usual. You should also be watching us on YouTube, NigeriaInfo99.3. Facebook Live also, NigeriaInfo99.3. We are also on Twitter, Nigeria Info FM, Instagram and Threads, Nigeria Info FM Lagos. You know the studio line already because it's borderlines, and you know on borderlines first you send a WhatsApp message 0809-597-5805. Yes, it's taking me a while. I'm slowly beginning to know that off heart. Now, we also have a female only line, as you know, 0801-465-7190. But you, of course, know our main line, which is 0700-993-993-993. Before the news, you heard a group of women scream, "Happy International Women's Day." Yes. Borderlines today is also going to be starting with International Women's Day. By that, I mean my guest who will be joining us very soon, okay, is Dr. Miriam Francois, female, so you see, International Women's Day. She's a journalist, she's a filmmaker, she's a writer, okay, she's a seasoned reporter. She's worked for the BBC World Service. She's done BBC News. She's done TRT World. She's worked and covered French politics, migrant issue, and Brexit. She's also produced several reports for the BBC at 6 and 10. You know the BBC News, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock news. Yes, I remember those. Including a French BLM special with Clive Meyer. You see, when we have women on this show, they are super. My guest was born Irish Catholic. Yes, indeed she was. She was born in London, actually. She was born in Camden, one of my old haunts, a place I hung out at very much when I was young. So how does a British... let's put it this way. Irish, Catholic, half French, born in London, then becomes a Muslim. Not only does she become a Muslim, she's actually translated one of the really important books in Islam, female books. So I am so looking forward to talking to her. Dr. Miriam. So Miriam is known for, I can see her joining now. Let me just give you what I call her catchphrase. "Oh, I'm sorry your Amazon package is late." When she joins us, I'm going to be getting her to tell you exactly what that means. So when she said that, literally went viral all over the world. And I say it too. "Oh, I'm sorry your Amazon package is late," because you know how precious you all get, you know. So I can see her now, so I'm not going to waste time because we don't have much time. And I know you people will start fighting with me for space and asking her questions and thinking it's your show instead of mine. Dr. Miriam, welcome. How are you? You are in a cold place, are you not?
I'm very sad to say that I am in a cold place. You can see me with my hoodie up.
I can.
It is Arctic in London right now, but yes.
Oh, good God. Where in London are you?
We're in West London right now.
Which part? Come on, I'm a London girl. Tell me which part.
Okay. So kind of towards Hammersmith area near the river.
Not bad, not bad. My ex used to live there. Not I don't bad. Go that direction anymore. We'll talk about that later. Good to have you.
You swerve the West now. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. I was just saying, let's start on a light note because it's International Women's Day. So happy International Women's Day to you.
Thank you. And likewise to you. I mean, it should obviously be International Women's Day every day.
Absolutely.
But we'll make a mark for it today.
Yeah, we'll let them get away with it, you know, so they don't accuse us of being selfish.
Yep.
Yeah. So I was just saying to my listeners that if they don't know you, your catchphrase, what I call your catchphrase, I'm sorry, your Amazon package is late. I don't think salute. Tell us. Tell them what that's all about, because they won't believe me.
Well, it's funny because a lot of people have obviously asked me since if I had prepared that line before I went on, and I can, you know, categorically confirm for the record now that that was not a pre-prepared line, obviously. Mm. But I think I was so taken back by the tone of the conversation that was obviously focused on you know, material things, you know, a material approach to the world, which is, you know, finance and these roots of Lockhaven, and it's costing a load of money. And I was, you know, there was such a huge gap between what I'm witnessing, what we're all witnessing, right? Which is, you know, tens of thousands of people being killed, you know, wounded, maimed, children, women, devastation on like such an unimaginable scale, and so much suffering, so much human suffering. And so for me, for the conversation to be kind of focused around finance and trade, when there is so much human suffering at stake, was unintelligible to my mind, to my worldview, to I think any you know, human focused worldview, really. You know, it's only really a worldview that places a primacy on money above human life that could justify a conversation on those terms. That's sort of how I see it. So that's where that comment came from.
Look, and then look, on my WhatsApp group, which is mostly men, I have this WhatsApp group, they're all mad, they're all mostly men, and then somebody posts, one of them that I'm close to, and I had to say to him today, you know that woman that you've got a crush on? She's my guest today. So he posted the clip of you saying on Sky News, ceasefire now, ceasefire now, ceasefire now.
Yeah. I mean, that was also not planned. I think if I was there today, I'd probably do exactly the same thing. You know, we are still in a situation where the people of Gaza are experiencing a relentless onslaught, you know, whether it's the bombings or the sniping or the kidnappings and the torture. Ceasefire now. I mean, you're hearing it again. Ceasefire now. We've needed a ceasefire for the last 5 months. I think that the fact that we don't have one is a real testament to the failure of the international community to stand up to the rules that we have set for ourselves as an international community. And it's a real betrayal of the human rights principles that we claim to hold so dear. And I think the real fear for me is that, you know, I often say this idea that once you allow the denigration of one person's humanity, you are actually also always allowing the denigration of your own. Because once you allow any principle to create an exception for somebody else, what you're always automatically doing is allowing the creation of an exception for yourself potentially in the future. And I think that's why we have to sort of have a radical humane approach to this, which is, I believe in radical humanity. Your humanity is inseparable from mine. Anything that affects you affects me. And if I don't recognize that, then I'm basically saying that actually in the future, if what affects me doesn't affect him or her, then they can also just ignore it. And that's not the world I want to live in. And I don't think that's the world most people want to live in anymore either. I think the era of allowing capitalism to dictate the principles according to which we live is done. It's cooked. We're watching six-year-old kids going down mines for iPhones. We're watching, you know, the people of Sudan, you know, starving, war. We're watching people here in the UK sixth wealthiest nation in the world who can't feed their children, who can't heat their homes. Enough already with the greed, with the extreme greed that has led us to where we are. We need a more human-focused economy, a more human-focused society. And I think, if anything, Gaza has really revealed that to us all in many ways.
Absolutely. Which brings me on to Biden, the man at the center, or should I say the twin at the center of this global crisis. That is, people think of it as just Middle East. It actually isn't just Middle East. It's global. It embraces and sort of, you know, consumes us all, because every single one of us, there is a bit of Palestine or the genocide in Gaza going on in different continents, in Africa, as you said, and all over. Biden's State of the Union address yesterday. So he suddenly starts to take a different tone. Do you think it was enough? Well, he said they're going to build a pier. And I don't know about you, when I heard a pier, I thought, well, Brighton Pier? Is that what you're planning to build? But, you know, you're my guest. You're Dr. Miriam. Over to you.
I mean, look, I think we're still dealing, unfortunately, in American smoke and mirrors. We're dealing with, you know, Biden recognizing that his current position is deeply unpopular with the Democrat Party, with many Democrat voters, and that he can't be seen. And I'm being very choosing my words closely here, that he cannot be seen to be doing nothing. And that's why, instead of doing what he needs to be doing, which is basically saying, Israel, we love you, we support you, but we cannot support what you're currently doing because it's an infringement of both international law and human rights law. And therefore, we're going to have to cut the US aid that we've been giving you. We're going to have to cut the weapons that we've been giving you until you sort of get your sanity back. And then we can sort of rethink this whole situation, which is really the line that we should all be taking. All of our governments at this stage should just be saying, no weapons, no funding to the Israel until it starts to respect the norms of the international community. And I think, what, you know, just to be super clear, so Gaza used to have a pier. Israel destroyed it. If you remember, there was a flotilla that tried to come into Gaza, I think back in 2016, was it? I'm probably getting the dates wrong. But the Gaza flotilla that was coming over from Turkey with aid. So there have been a numerous attempts to sort of bring in aid previously through other routes. Look, ultimately, there are seven entry and exit points into Gaza. Israel controls arguably six completely, and seven if you consider that actually Egypt can't really fart without Israeli permission. So ultimately, Israel controls all the entry and exit points to Gaza. It controls the registry. It controls, that's why there's no airport in Gaza. There's no actual international port, because it doesn't, these are occupied people. These are people under the occupation of Israel. So they have no control over their entry and exit points, over their trade, over their registry. They don't have, you know, their own army. So, you know, once you understand that, I think it's easier to see that actually what Biden is saying is much more directed at the US electorate and I think his own supporters than any real meaningful change in US policy. He could enact a meaningful change in US policy. He could, you know, do what other presidents have actually done in the past, not many, but at least one, which was to, you know, switch off the finances, which would send a very strong message that actually, you know, there is such a thing as international law, that we regularly, as the US, have invaded other countries for allegedly infringing, or that we try and impose at times by force. And there is such a thing as human rights, which are inalienable, and we cannot allow what we're seeing to go on. But that's not what's happening here.
Indeed. Now, when I hear from Cameron, he sounds sort of iffy. And I have to remember I'm a Nigerian. iffy. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, my Nigerian audience.
I love that.
Iffy is somebody that's sort of not here, not there, you know, can't quite decide which way to go, because he's basically a piece of silk. Blow him here, blow him there. Wherever it lands, it lands.
Indeed.
You know, and when you think that those are the men the men who are shaping the world that we all have to exist in. You have a Biden, you have a Blinken, you have a Netanyahu, you have a Rishi Sunak, who is basically made a speech the other day, shrinking the civil space, shrinking, you know, voices and dissenting voices.
Absolutely.
In the UK. You think of Starmer, oh God, Starmer the Salamander, you know, and so many. I mean, I give up. And then, I don't know about you, I find myself waking up every day asking, where is Angela Merkel? Angela Merkel, all is forgiven.
Yes, I know. I hear you. We do miss a much more sensible voice within the European space. I agree with you in that. I think, obviously, I mean, Angela Merkel was always a much more balanced figure, actually. Mm. I completely agree. We miss her. And I think it's interesting that actually we're talking on International Women's Day, and all of the pathetic excuse for leaders that you've just described are all male. And the one that we're sort of somewhat pining over, the influence that she did have was of course a female. And I think, you know, without getting into sort of gender wars around this, I think what I'm really getting at is something that I do deeply believe, which is that we have fallen into a highly sort of misogynistic, militaristic perspective in international politics, that we've bought into this idea that somehow the only way out of situations is wars and bombing. And if it's not working, we need more money for wars and more money for bombs. And ultimately, you know, if you study wars, you will see that at a certain point, no matter how strong one or either of the sides are, there is a point at which you have to sit at the negotiation table. And often that's when one side has worn out the other enough that, you know, they feel that the stakes are now too high not to get to the negotiation table. But ultimately, that is where we end up. And so my question, as, you know, a woman, as a mother, as somebody who cares about human life deeply, all human life, is why do we have to have all the bloodshed before we get to the discussion point? You know, why can't we just skip all that bit where we're like sending people's sons to be murdered? Because obviously, of course, it's men usually being sent to the front line. Let's be honest about that. There are women, of course, but predominantly men. Why are we sending our kids out to die when we know that actually, ultimately, this is going to have to be a negotiation where we accept that no one will come out happy? That's basically the premise of peace negotiations, is that no one emerges happy. But actually, that probably is a sign that you have found some sort of a middle ground, you know, that there is something in there for everyone, but also a lot that the parties are not particularly happy about. So, yeah, I mean, look, I think we have a real crisis of leadership. The fact that we are now looking at a Trump-led US is a very likely prediction. That we are also here in the UK, you know, that sort of talk of Keir Starmer being the next UK prime minister. I don't say that with much trepidation, because to be honest with you, I think what Starmer represents is Tories light, and what this country really needs is a sort of much more dramatic shift towards people-centered politics, something that recognizes that, you know, we've just had the announcement of a new budget here, and basically all the analysis sort of indicates the people who are going to benefit the most from the current budget are, ding, 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 drum roll, please, the riches.
The rich.
Surprise, surprise. And for the rest of us, what are we going to experience in real time? A likely 0.91% decrease in living standards. Decrease? Another decrease? How far are we going with this? Because people are squeezed. People in this country right now are squeezed. Working class families are struggling and have been struggling for decades. Middle class people are now struggling as well. And the only people who are really profiting over the current situation are the elites who are either in power or funding the media companies that justify the decisions being made in power. And at a certain point, I think if you continue to take people for mugs, if you continue to take the majority of the people that pay your salary, that pay your bills, for mugs, then they have a right at a certain point to make themselves heard by any means possible. And if you want to dub that extremism, Mr. Sunak, in a speech, if you want to dub people who are calling for solidarity with people being bombed under a plausible genocide extremism, then you know what? At this point, let's just own it. Let's just all call ourselves extremists and be done with it. Cool. We're all extremists. Halas, as we say in Arabic, we'll take it. We'll take it. Then we just know. We're the extremists, and you are, sir. Let us know what you are. If we're the extremists, what are you?
Indeed. It actually brings me to my next question. Is a very good segue. I want to talk about your career, your filmmaking career, your journalism, your academic, and everything that you have done has always been about, it's always been a symbol of your activism. It's always been a symbol of what you stand for and how you choose to stand for it. And today being International Women's Day, and I think, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's celebrated more in the global south than it is in the north. International Women's Day, we make such a fuss about it in Nigeria especially. So I know there are lots of young women who are listening, and of course, my colleagues, you know, in this station and beyond. How does one begin to sort of channel that passion into journalism, into that creative space, without compromising on your principles and what you stand for, in spite of the boundaries around you? You know, you've done that superbly well. So tell us.
Well, firstly, thank you so much. Thank you so much for saying that. And thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to talk about my career in the context of course, sort of principles, because I think that I really appreciate that recognition, because it's true. It's actually something that's been very important to me throughout my career, that my principles and my beliefs are reflected in the kind of work that I do. And so although I was in academia for a long time when I was doing my master's and my PhD, and then I went into journalism as a correspondent, as a reporter for a while, and then I transitioned into documentary filmmaking, which is what I do today, and which I love, and you know, we've got some very exciting projects in the pipeline for you. But I would say two things about kind of having a career that feels aligned with your own principles. One is there is in many cases a sort of direct contrast between routes that will get you money and routes that will get you personal satisfaction from alignment with your ideals. Mm. And I think very early on in your career, it's important to know what is important to you. What is, you know, if it's really important to you just to make money, and you know, I don't really even have judgment on that, because, you know, I didn't grow up in acute poverty. I didn't. Mm. So, you know, how am I going to judge someone who grew up in acute poverty who's objective is just to get money? Okay, I get it.
Yeah,
I understand. Mm. But if that's what you want to do, just be honest with yourself and clear with yourself, because you're going to also have to make compromises along that route of a different nature. Mm. If you want to follow your principles and follow a career that is very much aligned with your ideals, then there's a very high likelihood that the money will be a very secondary consideration in the choices that you're making. And of course, that has implications, right? That has implications for your household income, for your earnings. And I think, look, if you want to ask me very clearly, like I'm a Muslim, my belief, my conviction as a Muslim is that all we call wealth or the money that we acquire in our life rizq. It's your provision from God, mm-hmm. and that's determined for you. And no one or nothing can change that.
Mm.
And so I take the view that whatever is meant for me is already mine, and whatever is not meant for me, I will never acquire.
Mm.
And so I sort of, you know, that's a belief I have as a Muslim. Mm. I understand not everyone is of the same faith, but that's where my grounding comes from in that, is that, you know, I believe as a person of faith that my life has to be in service to something higher than myself. And I also choose to trust in God when it comes to my income. And I also choose to trust in God when it comes to the outcome of my decisions. Some may lead to personal satisfaction because I feel that I've done something positive that is helpful to others. And alhamdulillah, we say praise be to God for that. Mm-hmm. And other decisions might bring me wealth, but I try not to let the money be the guiding principle. But I think the most important advice I would give to a young person, a young woman thinking about a career at this point, is to just really be honest with yourself about what gives you personal satisfaction. Is it going to be seeing a whole load of zeros in your bank account? And it may be that, and then you should go after what you need to go after. But if it's not, if you know that no matter how much money you make, you're going to feel dead inside if you haven't sort of, you know, worked towards trying to emancipate your people, free Africa from the mantle of imperialism, whatever is your gig, you know what I mean? There's a whole range of causes out here.
Absolutely.
Then if you feel like if you don't commit to something deep in your heart that you are going to feel dead inside, then you should recognize that and own that and just know that there is so much beauty in the struggle as well. You know, I take huge inspiration from revolutionary leaders in my own life. Not that I'm suggesting that I am one, you know, I wouldn't arrogate that, but I take huge inspiration from revolutionary figures, people who sort of outlined a clear vision of the problems that they identify in the world, a sense of conviction around what they believe the solutions are, and then a commitment, personal and communal, to change. And those are my heroes, you know. I mean, I might learn how to contour from the Kardashians, but I'm definitely looking to Thomas Sankara and Paul Spenel when it comes to my personal ambitions and Maya Angelou and, you know. Exactly. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that contour. But look, we won't talk about that.
I mean, look, we all like a good contour, let's be fair.
Look, oh gosh, I'm having so much fun. Lagos, I know you've all got questions. You want to call in. Yes, you want to be part of my fun because, yes, I'm the only one laughing. 0700-993-993-993. Look,
we are laughing together.
We're laughing together. You don't know my listeners. They literally want to take the mic from me. So at some point, they'll start calling. And, you know, and honestly. So before
can I
that.
Say how chuffed I am to be in conversation with Lagos. That's wild. I'm so happy.
We're so happy to have you.
I'm so happy.
It's a crazy place. How can I describe Lagos? I don't know what you've been told about Lagos or what you've read, but I haven't lived in London.
I've heard through Burna Boy, that's it. That's it. I'm sorry. That's where it begins and ends with Burna Boy. I'm sorry. I'm a Londoner. That's what I know of Lagos.
You know what? You and I could be having lunch right now and they'll probably ask us to leave the restaurant, right? Because that's so funny. And he's a London boy as well. Bernard Damini.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
He's a London boy. He was a bad boy in London. But I get it. But Lagos? Lagos is so... For me, Lagos is sort of... it's a multiplication of all the colors that London has. Like, just think of in insane bursts. You know, remember there used to be opal fruits, and they say you put opal fruits in your mouth and it, you know, all the sort of flavors burst. That's Lagos. It's literally insane. And every corner is either an asylum, a beautiful color, or a joyful noise. That is Lagos.
Wow. I'm sold. I need to come visit.
We can't wait to have you. Okay, they're calling now. Before they tell me off, yeah. I better pick up their calls. Right. Hello. Uh-oh. You snooze, you lose. The line's cut off. You can call back 0700-993-993-993. But before you call back, I'm going to try and stick in another question. One of the things that... So, I think Nigeria is, I don't know what you know about sort of where Nigeria stands with Israel or on the, I call it the genocidal war in Gaza. Six of this and half a dozen of the other, because we're a very religious country. And mostly, you know, you find that a lot of the Christians felt compelled not necessarily willingly, felt compelled to actually have to support Israel because, you know, that's what the pastor said, because they thought Israel was the Israelites, etc., because most didn't know that Jesus was born, you know, in Palestine and all that stuff. Now, the question that rings, and believe it or not, that still rings till today. In fact, a discussion that I still had on WhatsApp yesterday is, what did Hamas think would happen after 7/10? What did Hamas expect Israel to do? And I want your opinion on this. I've often said, one of the things that I say to them is, number one, because 7/10 didn't happen in isolation. Number two, because resistance groups are not meant to be pretty. That's what history has taught us. Number three, go read up about the IRA. Now, Dr. Miriam, tell me, I mean, I'm going to put it over to you because sometimes they don't believe me. Over to you. What would you say to that person that says, well, what did Hamas think was going to happen after? What did they think Israel would do?
Yeah, so look, I think it's very complicated to make a judgment on people who have been occupied and lived under a brutal military occupation for the last 76 years. Not only obviously that, so the system of occupation that we're talking about is one in which Palestinians who are just normal people like you and I trying to go about their lives are restricted in every aspect of their life, are regularly arrested, detained, tortured, including children. You know, there are hundreds of children who end up in military detention every year. There have been several reports indicating the use, for example, of sexual assault against these children, that they're transported in cages between courts and the military detention centers, that in many cases they're denied access to lawyers, to conversations with their families. In many cases, we're talking about sometimes very, very young children, children under the age of 12. Mm. Okay, and this is without going into the abuse that women and men also experience of a similar nature. And then, of course, the idea that, you know, under the current occupation, Israeli settlers can come into your village, appropriate your home, your land, kill members of your family with zero accountability, because actually the conviction of rate of Palestinians within Israeli military courts is 99.9%. And the conviction rate of Israeli settlers in those in Israeli courts is naught point something. I mean, it's an extremely, extremely low rate of conviction. So essentially what you're talking about is people who have been suppressed, repressed, brutalized, exploited in many ways for decades and decades. And then when you come to Gaza in particular, Gaza obviously has had a blockade imposed on it for the last 17 years, a blockade which, by the way, Palestinians had been protesting non-violently against. They called it the silent march. They would march outside the gates to try and protest the blockade. Just non-violent marches, just calling to an end to the blockade. And they were met with mass killings of Palestinians during those protests, many people injured. And so, of course, at a certain point, if you are trying to argue for your freedom, that international law is on your side, that you have tried every nonviolent means to be heard, there will emerge within your liberation movement, which is for the most part actually a nonviolent movement for liberation. I mean, there's a lot of focus on Hamas, but Hamas are actually only a very small proportion and only have a small proportion of support amongst Palestinians, even in Gaza, right, which hasn't seen an election since 2006. It is worth repeating to people that as much as we keep talking about this being a war on Gaza, that, you know, the people of a war on Hamas that the people of Gaza sort of have to take responsibility for. How? They didn't elect these people since 2006. Why are children being made to pay the price for the actions of a group that is actually completely unaccountable and hasn't been elected by those very same people for, you know, what, coming up to two decades?
Yeah.
So I don't really buy this idea that, you know, we can hold the Palestinian people, particularly civilians in Gaza right now, in any way responsible for the acts that Hamas undertook. Hamas is a part of the liberation movement. It is a group that has decided to use certain tactics that many people, including myself, would find disturbing in many cases. You're never going to hear me say it's fine to go in and kill women and children or any, you know, civilians in any way. And of course, they would dispute that they do target civilians. But unfortunately, I think the reports we've had suggest that civilians have been killed in that attack. But ultimately, you're talking about a liberation movement. And I think there's that saying, which is, you know, if you're relying, who was it who said it? If you're relying on your the humanity of your oppressors to liberate you, you're going to wait a long time.
A very long time.
You know, that's not right. So they've already found a good reason to justify the oppression of these people. They have tried through every legal route that I can think of, the UN, multiple UN resolutions, nonviolent protesting for decades, and nobody's listening. And at a certain point, one small percentage of them decided to break out of the prison that they're contained in. I don't condone what happened, but I understand how it happened. And I think it has to be seen as part of this wider liberation movement. And ultimately, I would just like to say this. Why has it got to this? Why has it got to this, that these people are having to use these sorts of tactics? Why is international law not just being respected? Hamas would not be undertaking what they're doing if Israel respected the 1967 borders, which is also, by the way, people keep saying Hamas does not recognize Israel. That's not true. Since 2006, there's a de facto recognition of Israel by Hamas, which basically says that they would agree to a withdrawal of to the 1967 borders. They don't have to say that they recognize Hamas, Israel. The fact that they're saying a withdrawal to the 1967 borders in and of itself says that they accept that on the other side of those borders, there will be another state, right? The main people currently who object to two states are the Israeli government. The Israeli government are the ones who are refusing to accept the possibility of a Palestinian state and creating a situation where, you know, these occupied people, the indigenous people of the land, are being repressed, violently repressed, day in, day out for decades. And the one time where they react violently to that repression, everyone points the finger at them. And I think that particularly those of us in the global south, particularly those of us who have experienced the brutality of Western imperialism, should be a little bit sensitive and a little bit cautious about judging those who are retaliating against an ongoing occupation. That doesn't mean we approve of the means used. It just means that if you were in their situation, and many Africans have been in their own way,
absolutely
right, in their own way, in various countries, how did you think people should react, is what I would say.
Excellent, excellent. The lines are going. Ooh, hello.
Hello?
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What's your name and where you calling from, please?
I am Pastor Badamasi from Surulere.
Okay, go ahead, Pastor. What's your question, please? Dr. Miriam can hear you.
Yes. I want to ask this question.
Hi, Pastor.
Why are the Arab countries surrounding Palestine so silent now? Why are they so silent now?
Okay, thank you.
In those days of the Anwar Sadat, we see a lot of Arab countries supporting Palestinians. But today, why have they just backed out?
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Pastor, rather.
Thank you, Pastor. That's a really great question, Pastor. And I wish you could be in front of them to ask that question, because they frankly deserve it. And I think it's a question we have heard the Palestinians, especially those in Gaza, cry out. You know, I've seen how many videos of the Palestinians surrounded by, you know, destruction on a cataclysmic scale, sort of screaming out, where are the Arabs, right? Now, to answer this question, we're going to have to do a little bit of history. I don't know how familiar everyone is with the colonial history of the Middle East, but essentially, much like Africa was carved up by Western powers, so was the Middle East.
Indeed.
And when they carved up the Middle East and those countries eventually sought independence, they made sure, much like in many of your countries in Africa, that the leaders that would be in charge would be conciliatory, right? People who are not going to rock the boat, people who are going to, you know,
play their tune,
right? Make sure that they play the tune.
Yeah.
And there are multiple ways that can be achieved. You can make sure that the countries are militarily and economically dependent. You can make sure that the support that they receive from the US government, for example, you might be aware that Egypt is the second largest recipient of US aid after who? After Israel, because of course, the very poor country that is Israel is in need of the largest amount of US aid. It's very important when you're rollerblading down the beach in Tel Aviv that you have US aid to support, the bikini contests and whatever else that's happening while you sip on your lattes and your mojitos. Because if you haven't been to Tel Aviv yet, it basically is California.
Yes.
What I'm really saying is that I agree, Pastor, that actually in an ideal world, we would very much see the Arab countries in an autonomous position where they were able to make autonomous decisions with regards to their foreign policy. But I think what you'll find is that it's much the same question maybe that, you know, the DRC might ask Rwanda right now, or Rwanda might ask the DRC, neighboring countries might ask Sudan, why can't you intervene? Well, you know, Where are we looking? How far up?
Absolutely. I think arguably Rwanda might be the Egypt of Africa right now with regards to the DRC. Can't be trusted.
Right.
Yeah, playing both sides and not being vocal about their people, or not vocally standing behind their people.
But for reasons which, when maybe you understand Rwanda and its history and where it is currently, we also understand, right? Yeah. We say, okay, we don't necessarily agree, but do we understand why Rwanda is in the position that it is vis-a-vis what's happening? I think we do.
Absolutely. You know, given that Israel was part of the genocide in Rwanda as well, you know, it's all so very packaged.
It's
and
all
clear.
Interconnected. It's all interconnected. Yeah. You know, ultimately, we know that many of the forces who are being trained, in Israel go out to use those trainings in the Middle East, in Africa, and even in the NYC, NYPD police force, right? Mm. So it's all forces of control that we see ultimately connected to the same large funding source, what some people have historically called the great Satan, not me, but America.
Indeed. Look,
it's a joke. I still want to be able to enter America, please.
I'll make sure Biden.
I mean, you know how this works.
I'll make sure Biden doesn't hear that. I'll make sure he doesn't get told. given that it's International Women's Day and we've got to talk about, when we talk about conflict and war and genocide, etc., we have to talk about women in conflict and how war shapes and reshapes and affects women more so than men. We're seeing it in Palestine with regards to, you know, personal hygiene, not being access to, you know, to pads, and children dying and babies dying in the incubator. We have in Nigeria the history of our Chibok girls, which went all over the world. And incidentally, 280 plus girls just got abducted again yesterday. In Kaduna. It's 10 years, I think, of the Chibok girls next month. So it's, and then you look at Congo, DRC, there's a particular video that's trending of, I don't know whether you've seen it, of a woman who said, you know, she her and her husband were escaping and they were stopped by rebels. And yes, Lagos, this is really quite horrific. They were stopped by rebels, and the rebels got her husband. They chopped him into bits, and I'm trying to make this as easy as possible. They cut him into bits, cut his private parts, burnt it, and made her eat his private parts. She was pregnant.
I did.
At the time.
Yeah.
And they also, you know, they made her eat it, and then four of them raped her. We have to discuss about when you think of women across the world, young girls, what's your greatest fear, especially when it comes to war? Because like my producer sent to me, you know, why bother going to war when you know you're only going to end up negotiating? So for that, I hear, why bother actually going, putting women and children's lives at risk when you're only going to come back and negotiate in the first place?
Look, I think the hardest thing to sort of compute around war is that it's situations where women are the least present at the table when the decisions are being made about the violence, but they're the most likely to be affected by the violence. And I think that that is not by coincidence. Mm. I think if we had more women around the table when decisions were being made about, you know, extreme forms of violence that are likely to affect entire societies, then maybe we would have different decisions emerging from those forums. I mean, you mentioned, this horrific story, which I had actually seen. But I think we also have to, you know, in Gaza right now, we know that, the reality is there are 37 mothers a day being killed. That, you know, you mentioned obviously things like access to period, what we call period poverty, but it's much more than that now in Gaza, but also pregnant women not being able to have any. Can you imagine how terrifying it is to know that you're going to be delivering under bombs, under snipers, with no medical support? What if something's wrong with your child? Yeah. There's nothing you can do. There's nowhere you can go. Your life is at risk. The child's life is at risk. The fact that you carry such a huge emotional burden as a woman for the welfare of your babies, and that we're seeing so many, particularly premature babies, dying of lack of access to even the food and nutrition that they need. And we've seen so many children already now. I think it was over 18 who've already died of starvation in Gaza. And of course, starvation is always horrific. But when we realize that this is a forced starvation, this is the starvation of people when there are trucks literally meters away full of food, full of aid, then I think the horror of what we're talking about becomes even more compelling. Like, we are talking about, if you want to hear about the kinds of restrictions, for example, that the Israeli authorities have put even on the very small amounts of aid that have been allowed in, they banned things like nappies. Nappies are not being allowed in to Gaza right now. Explain that one. Why are nappies being banned? Why is baby formula not able to get into Gaza right now? To me, this is all part of the sort of collective punishment of the population, which always in these situations affects the most vulnerable first. So, whether you're a woman, a child, if you're disabled, there's all these sort of factors that will make you more vulnerable to the violence. And of course, we've also seen that when it comes to access to food for a starving population, women are more likely to have even less access to the food. Men will fight to try and get access to food, sometimes for themselves, sometimes for their families, but most women are not able to get into those menus. It's always the most vulnerable that are at the hardest end of the wedge. And I also think that's why all of our faith traditions, all of our moral philosophies do what? They ask us to center the most vulnerable.
Absolutely.
We always are asked to center the most vulnerable. And that's for a very good reason, is that none of us want to be in a position where if one day we are those most vulnerable, that we are trampled on. So, it's very tragic that we are, it's more than tragic. It's a telling indictment of our failure to learn from the past, that on this Women's Day 2024, that we are literally watching women in wars, whether it's, in the DRC, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's Ukraine, wherever it may be, Sudan, and that we continue to act as if war doesn't primarily negatively impact women, and that actually, sexual violence in war, of course, is also another aspect that we very rarely hear about. We know obviously that there was a debunking of the New York Times article that sort of alleged that there'd been all these sort of horrors committed, which isn't to say that sexual violence didn't happen, by the way, on the 7th of October. I am not of the camp that says that there was no sexual violence on that day. I wasn't there. Do I believe that sexual violence occurred? I think it'd be foolish to pretend it didn't. Absolutely. It's very rare in incidents like these that actual sexual violence doesn't occur. The question is whether it was systematic. Do you know what I mean? The question is, was it a Hamas systematic policy to go in there and do this? That I don't believe is the case. But do I believe that sexual violence occurred? Yes, I do.
Incidentally,
but I also know that
the time that's gone, because we're running out of time, it's funny you should say that. I've got, they're telling me I've got 2 minutes left. It's funny you should say that. When I went into Israel, and we spoke to families, you know, as a journalist and everything. One of the families actually said, when I asked him about the rape, he said, no, it wasn't a mass, it was criminal elements, right? That came in.
Exactly.
That so also broke through.
People don't realize.
From Gaza.
That's right. People don't realize.
Because Israel calls every Palestinian Hamas.
Exactly. And I think it's really important to reiterate what you just said, which is when the hole was created in the fence by Hamas, a lot of other people came through after that as well. And so did those people do things that are, you know, equally or more reproachable, including forms of sexual violence against the Israeli women that they encountered? I think they did. And that's despicable. It's just as despicable as the sexual violence that we're hearing being enacted on Palestinian women in detention too. There's no tit for tat here, right? If we stand, you know, as sort of witnesses to moral principles that we believe should be abided by for everyone, we really mean for everyone, right? There are no sides. There are no sides. There are just people. Right. And I think that's what's really crucial here, is not to sort of ever fall into the binaries that this conflict is sort of, many people report on it in a way that tries to encourage the sense of it being Muslims against Jews, or it being sort of people who hate Israel versus, it's none of that. It's none of that. There might be people like that, but it's not about that. You know, this shouldn't be about hatred of any people. It should actually be about the dignity and humanity of all people.
Thank you.
Regardless of creed, race, religion.
Excellent. We could go on. I know it sounds like, literally, like, we've got to do this again. We have to do this again.
I would love to. I'd be very happy to.
Oh, great. Because there's still so much for us to cover. My producer's talking to me in my ear. There's so much going on, and I've got questions, and the lines are going, but we've run out of time. Thank you so, so very, very much, Dr. Miriam. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. It was such a pleasure to be with you, Lagos. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You have a fabulous weekend.
You too. Power to the people.